This is the national public broadcast of W. Dean Mohammed, Muslim American Society leader. What follows is an interview for Canadian TV conducted at Muslim Journal newspaper, August the 21st, the year 2000.
Imam Mohammed, what was it like as a child having a father who believed himself to be the messenger of God?
Looking back, because when I was a child, I didn't know anything else but that. I didn't know the difference. Looking back, it was too heavy for my mind, and I didn't give it a serious thought. I accepted that he was the boss. My mother made us know that. And I accepted that he had a special relationship with God, and that God was really his instructor, instructing him. And as a child, I was told that. I accepted that. So I didn't question him. Some of us, the children, would say sometimes when we were complaining to ourselves about all the restrictions on us, we say, you know, Daddy might hear us. Daddy might can hear us while we're talking. We thought he had some superpowers, baby, and he could hear our thoughts and our conversation.
Was he authoritarian? Was he kind? Was he?
On the one hand, he was very kind, and also I would say much more merciful and tolerant than my mother. My mother, she would put the if you put the strap on you, and you would remember it for weeks. But my father, if he used the strap, we knew he wasn't trying to hurt us. In fact, after he struck us a few times, we'd get there, we'd laugh about it, you know. And on the other hand, he was a very serious person who insisted upon obedience. And if you disobeyed him in matters of religion or behavior or duties, he assigned certain duties to us through occasion. He was a very difficult man. You couldn't reason with him. You couldn't explain yourself to him. He didn't want to hear anything. He was right almost 100% of the time. What I recall him being wrong was, and I had to suffer that. He made a judgment that was not correct of me, but I couldn't speak back to him. I couldn't defend myself.
And as a child, what was your image?
Well, we had a picture of the man that came from Asia, Far East, and taught my father all that he learned of Islam, or didn't learn of Islam.
And the name of that man was?
Farad. But spelled F-A-R-D. His name was W. D. Farad, and they also called him W. Farad Muhammad. He taught my father gave him, well, the whole idea of how to establish the Nation of Islam. And he gave my father, too, hints of his divinity, and hints to my father of how my father should represent him. Yes, that he's God.
And your father was the messenger.
And that my father was the messenger of God. Yes. Well, he didn't say to my father that, but he left it to my father to reason that I'm his messenger and he's God.
And did you ever meet Farad?
I believe I did. In fact, I'm convinced I did. But I can't prove this to anyone.
So as a child, you would have been meeting God?
This was long after I'm married and have a child now. I had my oldest daughter, Layla, and I met a man. His name is Muhammad Abdullah. His name was Muhammad Abdullah. He passed several years ago. And I met him at my father's home. He was sitting at the table, the dining table, where a special guest would sit at the dining table. And he was a man about the size of my father, and a Pakistani man, I know now, a Pakistani man, who came from India very early. He went to Fiji Island, came to the United States in the 30s and the 40s. And he kept his head down. I came in and he kept his head down. He just looked up and put his head right back down. And my father said, "Son, meet the old gentleman here." And he usually didn't speak like that of people unless he had some prior knowledge of them and had been relaxed with them in some relationship. So he said, "Son, meet the old gentleman here." And he said, "This is Muhammad Abdullah from San Francisco." Said, "He thinks he can help me with my bronchitis. So he brought me some dried salmon fish," he said. That was the first time seeing this man. When I went back to the city where I was the minister for the Honorable Elijah Muhammad Nation of Islam, Philadelphia, I learned, he contacted me himself, in fact, and he said, "I have a newspaper." He said, "Could you maybe take some copies for me and help me sell the newspaper?" So I didn't know. I said to him, I said, "Can you get a copy? Let me see it. Get a copy of your newspaper to me and let me see it." He said, "Oh, sure. He said, I'll bring it today." So he did. He brought the newspaper and I looked at it and I went through it carefully and the contents were acceptable. I didn't see them making any trouble for me with the Honorable Elijah Muhammad or the Nation of Islam staff. So I said, "Yes, we'll take." I said, "We'll take 50 from you." So he was very happy. We started taking his papers. He said, "Do you know I teach Quran reading and I can help you with your Arabic?" I said, "I didn't know that." He said, "Do you want me to come? I can come to your house and teach." I said, "Yes."
How old were you at the time?
Let's see. I was 30, about 34 maybe.
But this is after you've left the nation, isn't it?
No, no.
Oh.
Well, it's way back there. I was a minister for the Honorable Elijah Muhammad in Philadelphia at the time. And when I saw this gentleman, the old gentleman, as my father said, sitting at the dining table when I came in, I was coming from Philadelphia to bring my monthly report to my father, as most of the ministers did from around the country. And I went back to Philadelphia, the city where I was a minister there, Temple Number 12, they called it at that time. I was the minister of Temple Number 12.
I want to go back to your retirement.
Yes.
Describe to me, if you can, how Islam professed itself within the Nation of Islam.
Then we thought we had Islam. But after we learned better, I can't say that was Islam. It was a strategy, a risk strategy, to introduce the Quran into America, into the black community of America, into the most neglected black community of America, the ghetto, the bad areas of Detroit. The gamble was that some of these people in this community would not be satisfied with this religion that I'm giving them. That's the one who conceived the Nation of Islam, Farad, the teacher of my father. And they will then begin to be curious and to search with critical eyes what I have given them. And they will get the hints to them that this is temporary. And they should go to the Quran. The Quran is the only pure authority. And that's what was established in the early years of the Nation of Islam. And after, too, all during the whole period of the life of the Nation of Islam, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad always said that the only pure book was the Quran. And he never treated the Quran, or treated the lessons that came from his teacher and him to us, a kind of catechism-like, to be memorized. He never treated those very precious documents of the Nation of Islam like he did the Quran. There was a higher respect he gave the Quran. But for some reason, I guess his teacher, Farad, told him that you shouldn't bother with the Quran, leave it for later. He didn't encourage us at all to read the Quran or to try to learn the Quran until much later.
You're saying it was more of a social message than a religious?
It was, exactly. It was a message for social moral uplift and social reform.
So were you not encouraged to follow a spiritual path?
Oh, yes, certainly. It was religion. I have to say it was religion, because there was everything that makes something religion. It was the idea of God, a divine being, and that you had to be accountable to that God. If you didn't, you'd be punished for your sins, for your wrongdoings. So it was religion, but it was not Islam. It definitely was not Islam. It had its own myth of creation, the origin of creation, the origin of the world. And it had its own myth of the moral nature of man.
What was its myth of creation?
The myth of creation was that all of this generated from God, who himself was material being, and that nothing ever existed for God except a material, that God was never without material existence, and that God himself, by some power that's only with God, created the world all around him. He was existing, and there was nothing else but him, and then he made the world all about, all the world that we know, he made that, and that God was a black man.
Black and male.
Yes, exactly. And along with that was that the belief that white people did not always exist. In fact, their very recent creation, according to that myth, says that they were created about 6,000 years ago.
The white man.
White man. That was created about 6,000 years ago by a black scientist who was experimenting on the genes of black man and the pigmentation of the black man. And he got an idea that he could make blacks who were of a different shade, lighter shade, together and continue that. And every time lighter ones came, he only made it light ones. And in 200 years, he would have white people.
And what about the yellow man, the red man?
No, 600 years, correction. 600 years, he would have white people. Yeah. Well, they didn't do much to explain that, but the notion was that all these races came because of that grafting out of the black man, white man, that these colors came. That before he got the white man, the pure white man, he got brown man, red man, brown man, yellow man, finally got white man.
Do you think this distortion was introduced to this version of Islam? Do you think this distortion was introduced to this version of Islam to give dignity to dispossessed black Americans?
Exactly. I know that's what the reason was. Just to make us feel that we got our own knowledge of everything. The white man doesn't have to tell us anything. We know the birth of creation, and we know our origin, our creation, and his, and we are superior to him. Just reverse of what the white supremacist world told us.
And did you go to special schools as a child?
I went only to the Muslim school. My parents would not allow me or my brothers and sisters to go to any school but the Muslim school. There were some members of the Temple of Islam who had some children outside, but most of the members, and when I was a boy, had their children inside the Muslim school. And we did not have the standard curriculum. We only had our curriculum.
And what did you think?
If it could be called a curriculum.
And what did you think what did you think of the life of mainstream America?
As a child,
the TV,
it was condemned. It was the devil's world, condemned by God, and would soon be destroyed. And we had to stick with ours, and we were going to be rescued before the destruction came and taken to Mecca or somewhere.
Was this a lightly held belief or a seriously?
Very seriously held belief by those who were innocent and accepted it. Yes. But for many, I don't think they ever took it very seriously. They just, believed, appreciated the new higher dignity and higher picture they had of themselves, you know, and appreciated the disciplines of the Nation of Islam that saved a lot of them from liquors and drugs, and taught them how to live a respectful life, respect even white folks, respect white people, especially if they employ you, give them honest day's work. So they appreciated the positive things in the teachings of the Nation of Islam. And they didn't deal with those things that would tie up their rational energies.
This early version of the Nation of Islam, was it based on, was it driving towards social revolution or just rehabilitating the black community?
I think mainly, no, not social revolution. I think it was designed for the African-American people only.
To
bring about change in them only.
In them, but not to overthrow, take on the police and the
authority. No, no, not at all. But if there are some radicals that situated to do that, yes, there were things in the teachings that they could use. And I do believe some of them did it. You heard of the zebra case in California? Yeah, where the daughter of a publisher of a very big paper in California joined the blacks who called themselves the Zebras, and called their organization partner the Zebras, and they had some of these more radical teachers of the Nation of Islam. And they were actually going out killing white folks. They killed a few white people in San Francisco area, in California. And when we heard about their teachings, we identified them as persons who had taken some of the teachings of the Nation of Islam and created a much more extreme organization. I'll give you what's in the lessons that they use. In the lessons it says, Muhammad, meaning the Prophet Muhammad, and all Muslims will kill a devil. Yes. And the reward for killing and bringing four heads in at one time is, I forget, I think it's a trip to the Holy City of Mecca or something like that. Yeah. So they could use that, you know, if they wanted to be violent, they could use that. And that's what they did. And I think they wouldn't have been able to even come up with any connection like that if it was not for an old man who was a pastor at a Christian church. And he was obviously hurt deeply by white society, and he joined the Elijah Muhammad, and he became a minister in the Nation of Islam. His name was simply RTX, and he began teaching only the more extreme and radical things of the lessons of the Nation of Islam, and Elijah Muhammad learned of that and stopped him from being a minister. But he didn't stop meeting with people, and we know that he was on the East Coast, but he moved to the West Coast. He moved to California area. So I do believe he's dead now. He was almost 80 when he joined my father. He lived a long time. he's dead now, but we do believe that he was the one who preached on the East Coast and caused the birth of an organization called Five Percenters. We know the one who really was known to set up the Five Percenters organization. Five Percenters.
What does the Five Percenters mean?
Five Percenters mean they believe in nothing but the material side. And that man is God, and we only believe in the material side. We believe that we can write our own philosophy of life. And that we have the thought. Every black man has this authority if he has the ability. So they split from the Nation of Islam. Yes, and they're still existing. There are still Five Percenters around. In fact, the young girl in the office there, her boyfriend is a Five Percenter. And some of them are more extreme than others. Her boyfriend is what I call a moderate among them, very moderate person among them. They're the much worse members of that movement that do nothing but preach negative things about the white man, and their whole focus is just on the evils of the white man and the divinity of the black man.
Well, there is some justification for the evil of the white man.
And the black man, too.
The black man, too. Yeah. How old were you when you started to understand that maybe the Nation of Islam was not speaking of the true Islam?
Well, I can't say because I don't know, but I do know that I was about to do the only prayer that we knew, which in Islam, I'm sure you're familiar with prayer in Islam, but prayer in Islam is not this. This is called dua. It means calling on God for help. So this is the prayer that we had. And we would do it standing or sitting, but formally it would be standing. We stand up in the temple. This is how we open prayer in the temple. And we finish, that's it. At home, the same thing. This is where we pray standing. Not kneeling, not nothing, not bowing, like, no. No sajda, no prostration, just this. So, and at home, just any time you wanted to call on God, you call on God like this. So my parents are gone to the temple meeting on Wednesday night, and it was a very special temple meeting. My father said, son, he said, we're going to have to leave it. He didn't leave me at home by myself, especially at night. This was like, the meeting was like 8 o'clock, starts at 8, and it's not expected to be over until around 10.
How old? You're 8 or 9 years old?
I am about 11 or 12 years old. Mm-hmm. And my older brothers are not there at the house. They took my youngest brother with me, Akbar. They took him with them. So my father said, son, your mother and I, we have to go to the temple tonight. There's something special we have to do. He said, we want you to stay here. So I said, yes, sir. I couldn't do it. I said, yes, sir. So they left, and the frame house, wooden frame house, 6116 Michigan, or South Side, Chicago. And the house was already spooky, you know. With everybody there, it was spooky at night. I'd hear cracks and sounds of the floor, I guess, adjusting with to the absence of the pressure that was on it when we were walking all around. So the house is talking, you know, and I get a little afraid, and I'm getting tired. It's almost 12 o'clock. It's after 11 o'clock, and they're not coming back yet, but he would do that. When he went out, sometimes he'd spend long hours at the temple. So I'm tired. I want to go to bed, so I'm a little afraid. So I hold my hands like this, and I start to say what we say. Bismillah. We said, Bismillah, la ilaha illallah. We didn't even pronounce it correctly. We said, Bismillah, la ilaha illallah, Farad Muhammad Rasulullah. Now, isn't that something? We're saying Farad Muhammad is the messenger of God, but consciously living with the idea that he's not the messenger of God. He's God, and this is the messenger of Elijah. So we were saying that. La ilaha illallah Farad Muhammad Rasulullah. And I said, and I'm seeing his picture of God in my mind, the picture that was popularized for us. I'm seeing his picture while I'm saying this. And something said in me, said, before I begin that prayer, something made me uncomfortable. I said, oh Allah, I made my own prayer. I said, as a boy, I'm a boy now. Oh, Allah, if I'm not seeing you correctly, please help me see you correctly. That's what I said. And then I asked, then I said that, La ilaha illallah, for I'm Muhammad Rasulullah. Ameen.
And what prompted you to ask that prayer?
I wasn't comfortable. I was afraid. I really wanted God to be with me. And I wasn't afraid that maybe this is not the way I'm supposed to see God. This man.
But something in you, Imam, yes, saw what? That there was not a truth here.
That's right. And that somebody is not truthful. Because I'm told that the white man is a devil. And this man I'm looking at, whose picture I see, looks like a white man.
Logic.
Yes.
So how did you...
It was something, like I said, it's too much for a child.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But a child like you, out. Mm-hmm. 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 You want to pull your jacket down? Sorry.
Yeah, still up. Yeah.
Looking good.
Thank you. All right.
Pull on your hand.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
So as a young boy, as a teenager, how did you begin to understand the different nature of Islam?
I think it began very early for me, but a child won't speak things that the child knows will get him in serious trouble and maybe never get out of that trouble to his parents. We kept those things to ourselves. But often I would be with my brothers, especially my brother Herbert and brother Akbar, and we would discuss certain things that was bothering our mind that didn't seem rational for us. As early as 14 in my life, 15. But having difficulty with the belief that God was the man that we had a picture of, Mr. Farad, who taught my father his ideas, began for me much earlier than that, maybe as early as 11 or 12 years old. And I do believe, as a boy, I remember going to the temple, and I remember sitting, and I would listen. I had a lot of respect for the nation of Islam, and especially for my father. My mother put that in me, and she would insist that I go to the temple well-dressed and be disciplined, and she would insist that I give something in charity. So she made me conscious of it, the importance of it. She says, you don't have but a nickel, give it in charity, she told me. Yes. And she would make sure, say, you got anything in your pocket? I said, one time I remember saying, no, ma'am. She said, well, here, take this nickel. She said, if you don't have but a nickel, give something in charity. So I did. I practiced that. So I'm sitting in the seats with the other members of the congregation, and I'm hearing these ministers speak and teaching. And I'm listening. I was a small child. I'm sure that I was no more than 6, 7, 5, maybe 5 or earlier. But I'm sitting there and I'm listening to what they're saying. And I was entertained by them. They entertained me. I found it interesting. But what stuck with me was what I got. You know, you don't have to get things in a word by word progression, like a sentence, a complete sentence, a correct sentence, in order for you to get a message from certain words that would be accented. From expressions on their faces, I'm getting message. And the message I got was that we should, first of all, be righteous and fear God, obey the teachings of Islam, and respect the Elijah Muhammad as a messenger of God. I'm getting these things. This is what I'm getting. And that I should respect all the ministers because they are his assistants. They're working with him to do this work. They are his co-workers. That I should have great respect for them, and I did, and that we wanted the best for our human life. We wanted a life of excellence, that we wanted to be perfectionists and trying to make our life better and better and better. So for me as a child, what I grew up holding on to and appreciating was the belief in equality, belief in justice, belief in treating each other fairly and respecting everybody, even the white man that we call devils, but respected, believing in a brotherhood, and that this brotherhood is a just brotherhood. Nobody is to be treated unfairly.
Where did you get this belief?
From them, from their preaching. Yes.
Even though they were preaching the white man was the devil?
They're preaching these other things too. Yes. And what was escaping, going out more than coming in, was the myth that I couldn't understand about the origin of man and the white man and the black man, and negative teachings against white man. For some reason, I wasn't buying all that. I'm not saying that I didn't believe I should hate white people. I believed I should hate white people. But something in me wasn't comfortable with them drumming it into me and drumming it into the people and talking about it, giving more time to that during the preaching hours than they gave to talking about God and man. I was more interested in God and man than I was in devil.
Are you saying that the teachings of true Islam were always there within the Nation of Islam?
A hint.
And you began
the Quran
to separate them out from the distorted teachings.
Yes, exactly. The Quran was there, and I would say a bait to bring us to want to one day learn Arabic. We were given to learn, memorize Alif, Bay, Te, Se, Jim, He. And that's not how I say it now, because I've learned it correctly now. And you, Alif, Bay, Te, Jim, okay, but not He. It's Alif, Ba, Ta, Jim, Ha. Ha. That's not how we were given it. Alif, Ba, Ta, Jim, He. Why? So you remember it, huh? Alif, Ba, Ta, Jim, He.
This is the Arabic.
Letters. Okay. The letters. A, B, like you would say ABCs. But he went all the way to the Ha, the H. That's why I did that. And had my father memorize it and told him to teach the children that. Teach them. Alif, Ba, Ta, Jim, He. First alphabet of the Arabic language, he said.
When did you start to read the Quran for yourself?
When my father got a teacher, and for us, our school in Chicago had its first teacher to teach us Arabic around 1949. The first teacher was half African American, half Arab, Moroccan, pardon me. And his father took him on the ship with him when he was a little boy, he said. His father was merchant marine. I believe that's what he said his father was. He said, so he would occasionally be on the ship with his father, and his father spoke Arabic, his father taught him Arabic. So he knew some Arabic. He wasn't fluent in Arabic. My father put an ad in the daily paper, a Chicago paper. I believe it was the Sun-Times, but I can't be sure. It could have been a paper that was called the Daily News at that time. It's not existing in not right now. And I think one of the bigger papers bought it out. This man came for the job. My father hired him.
And how old were you?
Maybe 13. Couldn't have been more than 14. About 13, maybe.
And how old were you when you began to read the Quran entirely for yourself, not in school, not being taught, but because you wanted?
Well, that took some time, but I began reading, trying to read the Quran for myself. Myself and my brother, Akbar, younger brother, who was also a student under Professor Jamil Diab. He's the third teacher. The first two teachers, they did not work too well. The first one, because, I don't know, I think he was just not serious about it. The second one was very serious, an old religious man, but he was very old. He couldn't speak English well enough to be successful. So he gave us himself. I remember he taught us two lessons, and the last lesson he gave us was Joe's Los Timos. Joe's Los Timos. You know, something you rhyme. He said Joe's was walnuts. Joe's Lowe's Almonds, King Figs, and Moe's Bananas.
What is this?
He's trying to teach us some Arabic words, but he couldn't speak English well enough. So he said, Joe's Lowe's King's Moe's, and then he went and took each word and he says, walnut, almond, fig, bananas. Then he, at the end of the class, he said, I'm not able to teach you because I can't speak English any English at all, Harley. He said, I won't be able to be your teacher, he said. So he told the class that, and my father accepted the, but he was actually almost having tears in his eyes when he left us. He couldn't speak to us in English.
When did you start to appreciate the beauty and the poetry of the class?
When Jamil Diab, Professor Jamil Diab was from Jerusalem. That was his home. He was a citizen of the states, of the United States and Chicago for many years, half of his life maybe. He spoke very good English. He was intelligent enough to know and respectful enough to know that he should not do anything to interfere with the Nation of Islam's influence over us, that he shouldn't say anything or teach us anything to disturb that. But he won my father's friendship, and my father supported him as a teacher for the whole time that he was our teacher, our instructor. And under him, we learned Arabic to read small surahs from the Quran, small chapters from the Quran. With my father actually making it possible and encouraging it.
And as you began to understand that the Islam you were discovering was not the Islam that was being taught,
understand as a human being, as an innocent child, and as a human being, I'm having difficulty understanding something that was not rational all the time. But I'm not at all trying to prove it wrong. I love my father and mother. I love the Nation of Islam. I love the ministers. I love everything, about it. Except they are violations of what we held high, So I love it. I'm a really a strong Muslim of the Nation of Islam. I found myself trying to bend and twist truth to make it fit or at least justify what all Elijah Muhammad was saying and doing. That went along for a long time.
Did you ever tell your father of your misgivings?
No, I did not. But he understood it and he didn't bother me. The first time that I spoke as a young student minister, not even a student minister at the time, a young boy, making an attempt to impress the congregation that maybe I can be a student minister. It was on Wednesday night that the minister would invite anybody to stand up and come up and express themselves to see if there was a possibility that there's a young minister, a future minister out there. So they opened up for youngsters and others to come up and speak. And the minister was James, his name was James, Minister James at that time, some ex. At that time, he later became Sheikh Shabazz, James Shabazz, a well-known, loved person by us. He said, "We want some of you young brothers to come up." And my friend Leroy, and I say, "Friend, this is my buddy. We hang out, so he knows my sins that maybe my father never know." So he's sitting over here, and he said, "I'm going up." And I was surprised when he said that, although I knew he had not the terrible problem of stage fright that I had. I was frightened to go up. And he went up and he spoke. He did a good job, I thought. He did a good job. So when he sat back down, I looked at him. I was just to say, I didn't say anything to him, but I slipped my eyes. I said, "Man, you all right? You did a good job." And he looked at me and he said, "Chicken."
When did you go up?
I went up then when he said chicken. I was so afraid. But I went up. I got up out of my seat and I went up there. And I was so afraid. But I looked at the people. And I saw their faces. And they, now that I think back on it, they were so happy to see Wallace D. Muhammad, the son of Elijah Muhammad, coming up to speak. So I looked at their faces, and they were asking me, say something, speak. I had to speak, and it just happened automatically for me. I came out. The true me came out. I said, we talk about the devil more than we talk about God. I said, something wrong with that. I said, we say, we shouldn't say in the name, the Christians shouldn't say in the name of Jesus Christ. We say because Jesus Christ is not God. We say he's a prophet, not God. I say, but we say in the name of Allah and in the name of his servant and messenger, the all-reliable Muhammad. I say, you all should say in the name of Allah, and we thank Allah for the all-reliable Muhammad. That was my first time I ever spoke. And I doubt if I was more than about 17, 18, maybe.
The real you came out.
Yes. And my father never stopped me and never criticized me for that. But the screen captain did. And he took it back to my father and said, he's saying something that's different. And he's telling others to say it. He's telling the ministers to say, in the name of Allah, and we thank Allah for his messenger, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. No, I didn't say messenger. I mean, we thank Allah for the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. But my father never confronted me. I know the captain, screen captain Raymond Shree, took that to him because I was told, my brothers and others told me he did it. And he never changed. But the minister himself, who was much my senior and was also my school teacher once, so he was the principal of school, Brother James, Minister James. My father's assistant in Chicago at the minute. He started saying it. He never said the old way anymore. He said, in the name of Allah, and we thank Allah for the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And it spread all over, went all over.
When you went up that first time, did you understand that something had changed in your life?
Yes, I did realize that I wanted to help my father make a better congregation, make his followers a better congregation. I was aware of that. And later in my years, like perhaps after I had a child, wife and child, my first child, Layla, daughter, I began to realize that it was something in the teachings of my father that was pushing me, and I was unconscious of it. Now I'm aware of it. At maybe 39 or 40, I'm aware that I'm just not doing this on my own. There's something in his teachings pushing me.
Is there something other than his teachings pushing you?
Something in his, yes. Yes, sir. Yeah. Being pushed by two. One, the good, rational, truthful spirit and language of the Nation of Islam. And on the other side, there is my desire to be the human being that I think is the true human being, the true human being, and to be that with all other human beings.
The definition of the true human being is
a humane person, a kind person, a person higher than the animals, etc. Yes, I start to appreciate that concept of man more and more, and want to be that man, that kind of that man, that ideal man more and more. And I start to appreciate language in the American society that encouraged that kind of thinking. So I came to appreciate the Constitution's concept of human being, of the Constitution of the United States concept of a human being, and this democracy's respect for a human being. I came to appreciate that in the devil, the language of the devil, of the devil society, right, in the white man's world. I came to appreciate it and strongly identify with it.
Mm-hmm. For you, what are the highest values of humanity?
What are the highest values of humanity? First of all, kindness toward self and others. Kindness toward self and others. And truthfulness. Truthfulness. many other values, but I think that's where I start.
You went to prison when you were 31.
Yes, you're right. You got it.
What were you in for?
Well, actually, the members of the Nation of Islam followed all of Elijah Muhammad's lead. And during World War II, there was a draft. My father told his followers that we could not accept a draft card. They didn't even get a draft card. Now, here it is, 1952, instead of 42. And I should register at 18 for the draft. And my father, in fact, it was a little earlier than 1952 when I was aware that I should. I'm aware, too, that my father is opposed to us going to service. So I told my father, I said, I'm going to have to go to jail. And he said, well, son, he said, maybe I can beat it. So I'm going to get some lawyers. He did. He got some terrific lawyers. And they worked to keep me out of jail. It went on in the courts for almost 7 years. And Selective Service accepted that I was a conscientious objector. They got me classified as a conscientious objector. So they ordered me to go to Elgin State Hospital to do civilian work as a Selective Service person. So I told my father, I said, Daddy, I say, I have a chance to go to Elgin State Hospital and learn to be a laboratory technician. Because I inquired, and they told me I could. I said, I would like to do that. I said, that way when I come out, I'd be able to earn more money. He said, son, he said, that would be the same as going, say, you shouldn't have never gone through all that then. You should have just went to the Army. I said, well, they don't put that. He said, I know. He cut me off. He said, I know. He said, but if it gets hot, he said, they will put you on the front line. That's what he told me. I didn't feel that. I didn't believe that. But I did say anything back to him, of course. So I went away. He would never say, don't do it, because he didn't want to be on the spot that he could be charged with telling me not to go to Selective Service. I knew that. And I wouldn't say anything to put him in a position where he would have to tell me that. I'm aware of his position and how serious it is. So I go on with this in my heart, that I'm obeying my father, but really I want to go to that hospital and do work as a conscientious objector.
And you didn't?
No.
And you went to prison?
And I was sentenced, right.
How long were you in prison for?
I was only there for about 14 months. I was paroled. When I first came up for parole, it was like maybe 9 months of imprisonment or so. I was rejected. And they didn't even give me reasons why they rejected me, but I was rejected. They turned me down. The second time I went up, and by the way, when I was sentenced, the judge said, I'm going to give this boy 3 years. So he's dominated by his father, that's what he said. He said he's dominated by his father. And then he looked at me. He wasn't speaking to me when he said, I'm going to get him 3 years. And he looked me right in the face. He said, I will recommend parole. That's what he told me.
What was it like in prison?
It was like hell.
White man's hell?
Any man's hell. No, it was, for me, it was hell, because I love my freedom. I love to be with my family. I love to, my freedom. That's it. I guess everything loves his freedom. It was very difficult. The first few months were terribly difficult. I was so having so much misery inside, and it was so strong, it started to make me even imagine things happening that I wouldn't imagine those things happening if I was in a normal situation. I start imagining that my daughter would walk into on the street and get ran over or something like that. Almost had nightmares. But I woke up one night, afraid that my daughter had fell from a high up. She was only like maybe about three, I think, when I was went to prison. So it was very difficult. I remember a young man about my age, maybe a little younger than I, 3 or 4 years younger. He might have been maybe 19 or 20. And he woke me up crying. It was a white man, white boy, young white man. He woke me up crying in his sleep, well, crying at night. And I didn't say anything to him, but the next day I got closer to him and wanted to be his friend. He knew it. So we became close friends. And what was hurting him so bad, he was in love with his wife that he had just married, and they had now they separated. And I too, but not as I was more, I had more time with my wife than he had, but I was terribly missing my wife, being the husband of my wife.
He was Christian?
Yes, he was Christian, yes. I think he was, I'm not sure, I think he was Jehovah's Witness.
How did he view his friend being black and a Muslim?
How did he? I don't, there was nothing indicated by him to me that would make me uncomfortable with him as just a person. I accepted him as just a person, not white or black.
Well, that's just a tolerance thing.
I think prisons will do that for you. Mm-hmm. If you got a friend in prison, you don't see any color.
And did your faith change in prison?
Yes, but it was a continuation because it has already changed before I went to prison. Before I went to prison, I'm seeing now that we have to make the teachings of the Nation of Islam more appealing to people who are free thinkers, who are rational and not afraid to question things. I was aware of that for years. In fact, I think when I told them we are teaching something that we are saying that the Christians are wrong to believe that Jesus is God, and here we are saying that this man is God in the name of Long Elijah Muhammad, in the name of, I think then I was beginning to feel uncomfortable with it and trying to do something about it. And when I was in prison, I had a lot of help to think freely and independently. I don't like to share this too often with people, but I'm going to share it with you because I think I should. I'm about to go to prison, but I'm in Chicago, and my father's going to another city for a speaking engagement. And we're at O'Hare Airport, and the security is there. And I was trained in the FOI, the Fruit of Islam, that teaches drill and discipline, moral discipline too, spiritual discipline, moral discipline to the men. And I'm joining the fruit because I am a male and I am a fruit to secure my father. And I'm standing behind him because there's a big window pane that we can see outside to the at the runways, look outside at the runways. And the men of the FOI who are trained for this, they're stationed or posted in certain areas to do just that, to be aware of what's happening outside and also inside. So my father turns around. I'm standing, he's like this close to me. And he turns around, and I'm standing looking this way. He turns around, he said, Wallace. Now, what are you doing behind my back? Are you trying to take my place? That's what he said to me. And it hurt me. It angered me. I was disappointed. I didn't think he'd say anything like that to me. So I said, Daddy, I'm just trying to protect your back along with the other brothers. But I was hurt. I went to prison with that hurt. And I think that helped me to question him more. To question whether he is the messenger of God or whether he is the man that I should obey with no reservations, whether it went against my own logic or against my own sense of what is morally correct or not. So it weakened that a lot. It was already weakened a little bit. But him suspecting me really caused, freed me to question him more freely and to disagree with him. So it was in prison that I decided, once I came back to the streets, I would never teach that teaching again. I would find another way to speak. I would never teach this teaching again. And when they released me, they ordered me not to do any public speaking. That was a condition for my parole, that I do no public speaking. And my father liked that. I went home and I found out that I learned from him, without him telling me, that he was very comfortable with me not doing any public speaking. when I began to speak public again, it was after I had been invited on the radio station, little radio station, by an African-American host, a woman, female host, to come on her station and speak. She had learned that I was a kind of open-minded Muslim who had an interest in just black people, not just as being Muslim, black people to be converted, but black people. So she learned of my praise for in the Urban League, and so she wanted to see this new thinking black Muslim, who's also the son of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, the leader, the messenger of Allah, they called him, the followers called him. So she had me on her station, and I have gotten much wiser now, so I know that I can't really come out with something that will be seen as an attack upon the Nation of Islam's ideas. So I chose to talk about nothing but myths. I said, in my opinion, the biggest problem for us, black people and all Americans, is not the things that we are always addressing, but a fantasy world. I say myths enslaves us. I say we are enslaved by myths. And she liked my conversation. We had changed. She said, you ought to write a book on this. If you write a book, will you come back? I said, I sure will. The FOI, they are alert to know when one of us is doing something. They had it recorded. They had somebody listen to me and record it. They brought the tape to my father. My father said to me, it's on Sunday, I'm at his house. He said, son, we have a tape here. No, I'm not going. No, no. This was 1972.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You
just
finished the story, Imam, about your father.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Should I just?
Just
all right.
Just one second.
And
get
going. Yes. When they brought this tape of my the interview that was done by this host, radio host in Lansing, Illinois. They thought they were going to get me put out of the Nation of Islam again, because I had been excommunicated before, or put out before. And my father was on a Sunday, and my father, he said, son, we have a tape of you, and we're going to play that tape. He said, Sultan, who is my nephew, and assistant, like a nurse to my father. He's his old age now. He's not in his best health. In fact, he's in his worst health. But he's in good spirit today, this Sunday. Every Sunday, he would have at this big, long, like, conference table dinner. But at that table, you could expect almost anything. That table could change from a dinner table all of a sudden to court. He'd actually have court at that table with all of his top staff people from headquarters Chicago there. So he said, son, he said, Sultan, he said, to my nephew, said, "I get that tape and put it on." And they did. Now, I wasn't afraid, but I was a little uneasy. So the tape is going on. My father, at one point, stood up, and he didn't even expect him to stand up. He's weak physically, too. He's not in his best condition, even as a sick man. He's in very bad condition. But he cheered him up, and he stood up, and his face actually, I saw red pink in his face. He was brighter than I am. But you couldn't see pink in his face, except that he was really, really emotional. A lot of blood had to rush to his head. So he stood up, and he applauded. And he looked at my mother. Now I was still standing. My mother was at the table. That was expected, too. Anytime on Sunday, she was expected. She's the hostess for the table. So he said, "Clara," said, "isn't this what we wanted?" And my mother smiled. She black-faced that woman, beautiful smile. She gave that big, beautiful smile. She said, "Yes." So I looked at the face of the staff people around her. I looked at their face, see how they were thinking that. And he looked at Raymond Sharif, Supreme Captain, and his assistant minister then, who was Yusuf Shaw, S-H-A-W. He said, and my brother was there too, Assistant Supreme Captain Elijah, and many of secretaries worked for my father's staff. Officials, this table filled with officials. He said, "My son can go anywhere he wants and preach." So he freed me to go make speeches. At up that point, I wasn't allowed to make any public speeches. Said, "My son can go anywhere he wants to speak." And he looked at me and he said, "Son, and preach that doctrine." It wasn't no doctrine. Well, he said, "And preach that doctrine."
And did you then take over the nation of Islam?
No. But I was free to go about throughout the United States where he have places, temples, or places of worship, and accept invitation from them to speak. And I started getting them. I got them. I went to New York, Boston, Philadelphia. I went all over. I went to practically every place in the Midwest area. All the big temples I went to. I went to LA, California, all over.
But you did eventually lead and then dissolve the nation.
Yes. What? Actually, I'm speaking as a person now who, as a minister now, who had been given special privileges from the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And through his staff, he's given me these privileges. And they are hearing me speak now with more authority and support than they've ever heard me, known me to have before. So I am building a new spirit and a new thinking in the following of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, which he himself permitted me to do or accepted that I do. And I am telling them that they have to prepare for a change that's coming. I said, "Change is coming." I said, "We're not always going to be able to do things the way we do them." And I used my father's language. I said, he said, "One day there will come a need for a new teaching. He said, and the teacher in that new time, he said, that teacher would not necessarily be held or bound to any of the old things, old ideas. I said, I quoted my father, I said, he may come with an altogether new message. He may not use any of the old language." I said, "So if the Honorable Elijah Muhammad said that, I said, we should be prepared to accept and make changes." And I said, "The Quran," I just put emphasis on the Quran. I said, "it had not been with us and not been in our reach." I said, "but I was taught Arabic in a school that was established by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad by a teacher that he hired." I said, "and I advised the ministers to study Arabic more," because they had already started to study Arabic. "Study Arabic more so you can understand the Quran." I said, "the Quran, you read the English," I said, "but you don't understand the Quran." I said, "if you knew how to read it in Arabic," I said, "I know how to read certain verses. I can read in Arabic now. And I know the meaning." I said, "oh, you see a new knowledge." So I was doing this to encourage them, kind of tricking them, you know, encourage them to learn Arabic, to put more effort in to learn Arabic so they can read the Quran in its original language, in Arabic. No one was preventing me from doing that. I didn't receive any problems. But I was told that a few of the ministers were very uncomfortable with me, and one of them was Minister Farquhar, who was the minister of New York, that they were very uncomfortable with me. But I was permitted to do that. So this is the beginning of me being the main factor for a change in the religious thinking of the Nation of Islam.
You spoke earlier of myths being things that
enslave. Yes, enslave the mind and the spirit.
What myths enslave us?
I was speaking directly as far as my intent, but I was speaking indirectly as far as the reality to the following of my father. I'm trying to get them to really look at what they've been taught and see that it's myth, a lot of it's myth, the myth of the origin of man and et cetera, and that these things enslave us, and they are worse forms of, they create more, their shackles are worse than the other shackles that we wear.
Looking at this country in the year 2000, what myth?
This country, for me, I don't like to do this, you know, but for me, Sunday school Christianity for children shouldn't be for adults. I'm sorry I had to say this. Shouldn't be for adults. Adults shouldn't believe those things. Yeah. They have to have interpretation for adults. If we don't, I think we limit our own intelligence.
You're talking about a literal translation.
Yes, the literal Bible translation, right, of the myths, what I call myths, religious myths.
Mm-hmm. And what are the myths in Canaan?
Myths that we have because of our religious beliefs. The white race is superior and the best, and Jesus is white man, peace be on him, and suggests that God is white, white something, spirit of what, which is true, he is white spirit, being pure spirit, and that black people are descended from Ham. Now, all Christians don't believe that, all church people weren't taught this, but some denominations identify black people as the children of Ham, and curse because of Ham. The curse didn't fall on Ham directly. That God said the curse won't fall on you directly, meaning Ham, but will fall on your descendants, Canaan, and we are the children of Canaan. And another myth is that we are the children of Hagar. We are Hagar's children. This is in Christianity, church people. And it came to us, you know, although it's not believed that story about Ham and black people being cursed is not believed by the great majority of denominations, Christians. But it reached us, and for us, we think all Christians see us as the children of the cursed children. And that's where I was, I would say, entertaining in my mind while I was telling the woman who was in it, who was questioning me on the radio program about my beliefs. And I was telling her that I think myths enslave us more than anything else.
There is a myth about Islam. That it is intolerant, that
yes.
It is militant, that
yes.
It is political. How
yes.
Did this myth come into being?
The colonial days, the days of colonialism, did serious psychological, emotional damage to many victims of it, like it did to us, slavery in the South did to us, you know? And I believe many Arabs suffer similar kind of psychological wounds that we suffer as black people when we look back at slavery and et cetera. Or some of us can't get out of that time. We still think, you know, that we are not accepted fully by white people. And because of that, along with the political difficulties they have, like Palestine, the Palestinians and the Israelis, they're supported by, they are dominated by people much stronger than them militarily. They can't defeat them. So they have to live with that reality. So they are desperate to fight off what they call, the Israelis, they call the enemy, desperate to fight them off. Now I'm going back into time, not just now. Now is much better. But 20 or 30 years ago is much worse, less than that maybe. So they are not, these people.
In the past few decades, much violence has been committed in the name of Allah and Islam. And it's made this connection between intolerance and Islamic faith. How has this come about?
We take for granted that because a person says he's a Muslim, he knows his religion. But Islam in most of the Muslim world perhaps is not understood and known on the level that Christianity is understood and known in America. And it's because, as many of the scholars of Islam say now, we don't have really Islamic governments. And Islam, and for many Muslim governments, is persecuted. Believers are persecuted. They are not allowed freedom to practice, to study their religion, learn their religion, and practice it.
So you wouldn't call the government of Iran an Islamic government?
I would call it an Islamic government. Yes, it is an Islamic government. The reason there is different from the reason perhaps in other areas, in most of the Islamic world. But I think the first reason is ignorance, religious ignorance of their own religion, of our own religion. And when you have political conflict, you have desperate persons who are desperate to get their lives back in their own hands, that their lands have been occupied by what they call foreigners, their privileges have been denied them to live their religion as they want to live it, you have persons not informed in religion coming to an organization of perhaps a military man who's not perhaps informed himself, but he will also have a religious man, a spiritual man, assisting him. And these two, both of them, are ready for revolution, violent revolution, and they will begin to recruit. And the people they recruit will be, most of them will be people who don't know their religion that well. So they can follow, they can be blindly led. I'm not saying all these organizations are wrong or the people are bad. I'm not saying that because I don't believe that's the truth. But what I'm saying is the extremes to which they go to accomplish their ends is not approved by the Quran, not approved by Muhammad the Prophet, not reflecting what is real Islam. In fact, hurting the image of Islam. To make the innocent pay for the guilty is not Islam. Not accepted, no kind of way. No way we can justify that. Like taking hostages, innocent people who are hostages, taking hostages. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth is not Islam.
Why do these people then do it in the name of Islam?
Because they don't know their religion that well. And they, as I said, and they are led by people that they respect They have knowledge of Islam authority. But these people have been so psychologically damaged that they ignore what Islam says. I'm talking about their generals. I'm talking about the advisors, the religious advisors to the generals. These people are so hurt by what has happened that they can't think. They can't think straight in Islam, and they don't care to think straight in Islam.
Is calling for the life of Salman Rushdie, is that also Islam?
Well, that could be considered Islam by some people if they go back and study history and get something out of history. But in my opinion, the justification for it doesn't exist. Because when an apostate was killed in the time of the Prophet, he wasn't killed for rejecting Islam or for turning down Islam and going to another religion. He was killed for being a turncoat in time of war. So actually, this ruling was a ruling against persons who would go to the enemy side and change religions and be with the enemy during times of war. So it's actually treason. It's an act of treason in wartime. And it was punishable by death. But since these persons are recorded in history as persons who changed their religion for another religion, for the enemy's religion, the new thinkers, they look at only that and say, yes, the apostate should be killed.
Why do you think, speaking of fundamentalist religion in general, whether it's Jewish or Christian or Hindu or Islam, why do you think fundamentalist approach to religion breeds intolerance?
We're responding more to what's aggravating us, what's torturing us, what's paining us, than we are to the commandments of God. That's the reason for it.
And intolerance is a reaction to our pain?
Well, in certain cases, we're supposed to be intolerant. Not that we are not supposed to be intolerant under all conditions and in any circumstance. No, we ought to be intolerant. But this extreme that we go to that calls any moral society to see us in a bad image, that wouldn't happen if we did not let our misery blind us to our obedience to God, the Quran, the Holy Book, and the way of Muhammad the Prophet. When Muhammad the Prophet was in war with people, he told his soldiers and all learned teachers in this religion, called members of the ulama, the learned scholars, they would have to agree with me, and they would judge that the imam is correct. They would say, if they were present, he told his soldiers to see that you not attack any unarmed person, only those carrying arms against you. And he said, don't even harm their trees. They have to live on those two things. So we're talking about a humane leader, Muhammad the Prophet, very humane person. In spite of what Western world in some of this literature says about Prophet Muhammad as a fanatic, a warmonger, he was not that. He hated war. He hated to go to war. He hated to kill anybody. And the revelation had to come to him from God saying, now you're permitted to go to war. And the reason was that your people are being killed, you're being persecuted, and killed.
In Orthodox Islam, how is Orthodox religion, how is Orthodox Islam a religion of peace?
How is it a religion of peace? It is a religion of peace because the main purpose of Islam is to invite us to have a relationship with God that satisfies the need in the soul to be at peace, and a relationship with man that makes it much more easier for us to have peace on this earth. And that relationship with man is that you accept that all men are created by the same God, and that all men are one human family, belong to one human family, that began with our first ancestors, Adam, and you say Eve. For us, it's another name, but it's definitely the first man and woman, for both. They say Hawa. Hawa. But that name, the name doesn't matter. It's the fact that we believe that all of us are descendants from one man and one woman, one father, one mother, mates, husband and wife. So religion is intended to give us a picture of ourselves as a family, in spite of our separate families. It's to give us a picture of us as one family in the beginning. And the message is to us that as it was in the beginning, so shall it be in the end. That in the end, you have to again accept that you are one human family so that you can have peace on earth. So religion is Islam, religion, Christianity, and Islam, and Judaism is all about peace. You wouldn't have religion if you weren't having this need for peace in your soul and believing that there's a cause, a reason for all this, and God is the first cause.
Now, in Islam, the Old Testament and what we call the New Testament are recognized as spiritual works.
Yes.
The Quran is the third episode, so to speak.
Yes.
As someone who knows all three of them, how does the Quran differ from the Old and New Testament? And
The Quran differs from the Torah of the Old Testament and what we call the Injil or the Gospel, the New Testament, insisting that God is one and you make nothing else a God with God, even though you translate it as expressions of the One. God is one, but he expresses himself as Jesus Christ and as a Holy Ghost, three in one. This Trinity is not accepted by Islam or in the Quran.
Yet Jesus is accepted.
Jesus accepted. Not only is Jesus accepted, but also Christ is accepted. Yes, we believe that Jesus also Christ is Christ. And we believe in the Immaculate Conception. We don't call it that. That's Christian language, Christian theology, language of Christian theology. But we believe that Jesus Christ is not the Son of a man, but Jesus Christ is the Word of God and a Spirit from God. The Word of God and a Spirit from God.
In character, how are the two sets of writings different?
In character, you mean?
The Quran is a bit more poetic.
Okay, I thought that's probably what you, yes. The Quran is rhythmic, more rhythmic. And perhaps, no, it's not any more poetic than the Bible. But more rhythmic, I would say, with reference to sound, more poetic. But to me, poetry comes in pictures, not just sound.
Could you recite some of the Quran to me in Arabic?
Yes, I can. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم والعصر إن الإنسان لفي خسر إلا الذين آمنوا وعملوا الصالحات وتواصوا بالحق وتواصوا بالصبر. That is a verse that's called Time Down Through the Ages in the Quran, a chapter, a real small chapter. And it begins by saying, وَالْعَصْرِ in concerning the hour, إن الإنسان لفي خسر, surely all people, all mankind, is lost. إِلَّا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا, except those who have the faith, وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ, and they have righteous deeds. وتواصل بالحق, and they work together to advance truth, وتواصل بالصبر, and they cooperate for patience, for the sake of patience.
Given that, why has Islam been so maligned in North America?
Yes. Because good people and bad people have been given power. Power to rule nations, power over institutions, etc. And many times it's the bad person, and you don't need too many bad people getting that shot to have the world messed up.
When did Islam first come to America?
As far as we know, according to reports we have from Muslims who came to this new part of the world, we are told, and it's documented, I can't recall the author or the name of the publication right now, but it went from that publication, and it appears in many publications now by Muslims, that the first Muslims were really on the ship that came from Spain with the Columbus. He wasn't the only one that discovered it, as you know. But the Muslims were thought to have come with the ship that came with Columbus, that Columbus brought to America. And we know that Muslims have been in Yemen, Yemenite Muslims, have been in Detroit for maybe 150 years, for a long time. And in some parts of the New World, Portugal, Brazil, and yes, I say Portugal too, and some other South American states, the Muslims have been there for a long, long time, for a few centuries. And in the United States, it's believed that Muslims of Detroit, Ohio area, and Chicago have been here for at least better than 150 years, and these places for better than 150 years, and perhaps much, much, much longer.
In the black community in particular?
Muslims didn't become known as Muslims in the black community until the beginning of Ahmadiyya preachers of Islam coming into America and proselytizing in the black community.
In what year?
I think it goes back as early as the 20s. I'm pretty sure 1928-29 they were here. Maybe a little earlier, but at least back to the 20s.
And what was the appeal of Islam to black
By the Ahmadiyyas. Yes, Islam was introduced by the Ahmadiyyas as early as the 1920s.
The 20s, right?
Yes.
What particular appeal did Islam have for the black community?
When it was introduced into the black community by preachers of the Ahmadiyya movement, it had its origin in Pakistan, Lahore, Pakistan. It was introduced as the natural inheritance of all people, and knew more than any other people, speaking to blacks, they would be speaking to us, have been cut off from your heritage more than any other people. So you should know Islam is the natural inheritance of all humanity, of all people. I think that was the strongest appeal. African American people, since cut off from African history and culture, we have suffered an identity problem, and we're looking for our human contents, you know, We don't think we have all of them back yet. And an appeal for us to get our heritage, our human heritage, had a big welcome in the African-American community. Many rejected Islam, not because that didn't appeal to them. It was because the religion itself was not as appealing to them as was that the Baptist faith or something, you know. But Islam has many other appeals to us. I think the emphasis on rational faith appeals to many African Americans who live lives of, I would say, myth and lives of fantasy. Now, this is my criticism. I think most African Americans have a more shallow knowledge of their religion than most whites. Yes, there's a big white minority that I put in the same group. But on the whole, I think there are many more whites with a deeper understanding of Christianity than blacks have. And I don't think that's our fault. I think it's the fault of slavery and the after effects of slavery.
You could say the same thing to the extreme fundamentalist Christian community.
Certainly.
How dare you say that you speak in the name of Christ and Christianity when your understanding of the religion is so shallow?
Yes.
And that didn't come part to slavery.
No. 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 As I said, there's a minority in the whites, too. But I think more of us have that kind of religion than whites. We have a religion that means go, you've been serious too long. Go and take a big glass or a fifth of the wine of Christianity and let it all hang out Sunday at the church and come back home relieved. So you can face another reality, another week of reality.
What is it about religion, do you think, that makes some people so certain in that it gives them the power to say, I'm right, you're wrong, I'm saved, you're damned, I'm good, you're bad? Religion seems to give many people that power. What is it about it?
About religion?
Yes. They don't do it in the name of politics so much or social movements, but in the name of religion, people will stand up and get very certain about who's damned, who's saved, who's right, who's wrong. Why?
Because you have a higher authority. You have God. God is higher the authority than the world, you know, higher authority than the president or the principal of the school or whatever, you know. So you have a higher authority. You have an absolute authority that you can use as your defense, that God said this. And both books, I'm a student of both books, not just the Quran, both books, the books of Holy Book of Muslims and Christians, tells us that there's a danger in going to these books without innocent heart, an innocent heart, that these books will lead the person who's not innocent further astray.
How do you find an innocent heart?
In our book, the Quran, it says none can touch it except the pure heart, the purified.
I'm going to ask you to
say
that again.
Yes. In my book, the Quran said that none can touch the book except the pure heart. And that means touch it with our hands. It means your soul will not really experience and touch the purity of the book and get the benefit of it if you have bad intentions or if you are not yourself an innocent person. You're coming into it for some self-advantage. You want to use it as a weapon against somebody. your enemy, or you want to put down certain people, and you want to lift up other people. So if you have something like that in your heart, says, it will do nothing but add to your disease. I'm giving you the exact language of the Quran. It will do nothing but add to your disease. And again, I'm speaking of our book now, because I'm a more of authority in our book. It says, this book is made of two forms or characteristics.